This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. This week's episode combines two of my favorite things in the world. It's about archiving and the history of game shows. You guys know I love history. Obviously, I do this podcast, but game shows fascinate me. And actually, like one of me and Gary Fletcher, our associate producers, one of the things we bond over has been, number one, we hosted a comedy game show together for a long time, but now The Price is Right. We both love it. It's an amazing show. And so I decided it'd be fun to try to do an episode on this. Just so happens that the Strong Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, a few weeks before I started looking to book this show, they had released a press release about this new archive. It's the Game Show History Archive that they are building. So I got in touch with them, and our guests today are outstanding. We have Bob Bowden, who is a veteran game show producer. He has lived the life. His mentor was Dick Clark. He was the first student intern on The Price is Right. This guy was on set helping Alex Trebek prep when they were rebooting Jeopardy, which a lot of people don't remember, went off the air for a while and then came back on with Alex Trebek. This guy has lived the dream. So talking to him about the archive, how he's contributed to it, is remarkable, and just his experiences in all of this. And of course, we talk about Jeopardy. We talk about his relationships with the big winners and what he thinks makes that show great. The other guest we have here is the Vice President of Acquisitions for the Strong Museum, Chris Bench. He is the one who is overseeing this effort, and he does an incredible job, guys, incredible job of explaining why this history matters and what we can learn from looking at game shows. And I, you know, as you'll hear at the end of this episode, I ask him questions and I can't even imagine getting, I don't think there's a wordsmith better answer than the way he really, really points out what matters about this history. And so I hope you guys enjoy this. Thanks for supporting The Road to Now. If you wanted to go give us 5 stars and a review on Apple Music, that would be great. If you wanted to support us on Patreon, that would be fantastic. I know a lot of you guys already do, and we thank you for it. And maybe you're just interested in this episode alone. That's great. If you go to the episode page of theroadtonow.com, you can go to the episode page for this episode where you can find the links that our guests asked us to share. FunnyYouShouldAsk.tv, the show that Bob Bowden's working on now. And you can find out more about the Strong Museum of Play by going to one of the greatest URLs there is, museumofplay.org. So without further ado, please enjoy the Game Show Archive with Bob Bowden and Chris Bench. I just want to take a second here in this introduction and talk to our friend, Jamie Jeschke from La Cosecha Coffee. Jamie, how are you doing, man?
Real good, Ben. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. I just wanted to have you on this intro because you have been sponsoring us for years. We love your coffee. We love what you guys do out there in Maplewood, Missouri, right outside of St. Louis. And one of my favorite things now is that we'll get people who hit us up on social media, unrelated to anything else, and be like, you're right, La Cosecha Coffee is so good. So tell us about what you guys are doing.
You know, we're just a small roaster and coffee bar in St. Louis, and we were just wanting to expand our online presence. And I was listening to your podcast, and I you guys approached us about being a sponsor, and I was thinking this would be a good way to get a more national audience. And so, you know, it's taken a while. It's taken some baby steps here, you know, getting where we need to be. But I feel like, especially last year, we just really started getting a lot of your listeners on board with ordering coffee.
That's great. Given the repeat customers, you know, that are coming from Road to Now to you, do you have any suggestions for somebody who really likes La Cosecha Coffee, but sometimes we'll forget to order and run out?
Totally. The number one thing that we've noticed that people have enjoyed is our subscription service, and they'll just keep coming to you and you don't have to think about it.
Well, that's awesome, man. I'm glad you could join us. And the website is lacosechacoffee.com. That's LACOSECHA.com. Use promo code RTN10 the number 10 for 10% off your order. So thanks for being here. It's nice to be able to reintroduce you again to our listeners. Have a great day, man.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Bob Bowden and Chris Bench, welcome to the Road to Now.
Great to be here.
For those guys who can't hear, Bob just made a very nice gesture with his hands. We got to translate this for the audio audience. You guys are here because I've just got to say, I'm not going to go on too long, but I'm pretty excited about what you guys are doing. You guys don't know this about me, but I'm a history professor, but I also have written and hosted my own comedy game show in Nashville for about 5 years because I love game shows so much. And the fact that you've taken game shows in history and put them in one place is amazing. So, but aside from interest, I think there's some real value to this that kind of hits a lot of places that we might miss when we're historians or when collections are made. So we'll start off by asking you, Chris, since you're the VP of collections, how did this happen and why? Why an archive of game show history?
Well, I owe it all to my colleague, Bob Bowden, and his friend and colleague, Howard Blumenthal, because they came to me and the Strong Museum about a year ago. This has been sort of a year in gestation with this idea that game shows are an important part of, as you say, history, American popular culture. They're an important commercial artifact of entertainment. And there was no place that was capturing, saving, preserving, sharing that. And there were wonderful opportunities with people who were passing on that shouldn't have gone without their stories being captured. The Strong Museum is the National Museum of Play, and we've got the World Video Game Hall of Fame, the National Toy Hall of Fame. And we said, game shows are so much about play as well. We should have a way to handle game shows the way we do these other areas of play.
And you teamed up with Bob Bowden, who when I wrote and asked, you know, could we do an interview here? They were like, sure. How about I was expecting to maybe talk to Chris, you know, someone who's acquiring. And then they were like, how about Bob Bowden? I was like, what? Because Bob Bowden is a living history of game shows. The man has worked on pretty much every game show you've ever heard of. I mean, he's had a successful career that goes back well into the mid 20th century. So Bob, how did you translate? I say, first of all, could you talk about some of the big shows you've worked on and your experience, and then how you decided to be a part of this archive?
Sure. Well, my fascination for game shows started at the age of 6 when I went to my first taping of a game show, which was Password. And so many of the titles of shows that I've worked on over the years are back now in new versions, which makes someone like me, who is at my core a fan and enthusiast, in addition to being a historian and a working producer, by the way, makes me so excited that any night of the week, I can watch any of the shows that I grew up with, that I love, and that I worked on. Of the shows that are on ABC in prime time right now, I believe I've worked on 6 of them, including the $100,000 pyramid, which was the $25,000 pyramid when I worked on it. And Press Your Luck, I worked on the original version of that at CBS. Worked on Match Game in 2 different variants, one on ABC and the Canadian version that was on just a few years ago. And I've worked on To Tell the Truth, and I worked on Jeopardy briefly. I was a freelance question writer on Jeopardy in the first season of the current version with Alex Trebek. I was a producer on Family Feud, the first season of that as well with Louis Anderson. And I had a show on for 4 years at Game Show Network that's still running and reruns called The Chase, which is back on ABC in a new version. And a show I created with Dick Clark 22 years ago called Greed was on Fox in prime time. And right now I'm working on a show called Funny You Should Ask, which is a daily syndicated strip, celebrity comedy game show. I work with Byron Allen and Scott Satin on that for Byron's company, Entertainment Studios. And so I'm still in it, and I love it. And I can't wait for the world to come back so that I can go visit all my favorite shows and be a part of it. It's a wonderful, wonderful genre that I so love.
So you've worked on all these shows, and you yourself have amassed this great collection. And I've got so many things. I mean, I've read about your background. I learned so much about game shows from learning about you, about like how you were there when Alex Trebek was training to be the host of yes. Jeopardy. The first run through, the pre-recording. You worked with Dick Clark. You went to UCLA at a time when people in your part of the world didn't even know that was a college.
I'm not that old. Wait a minute.
No, I heard you tell a story. I heard you tell a story because I do my research. And my research is usually building things and listening to interviews with people if they're available. I heard you tell a story that the guy that did your counselor, you were like, I want to go to UCLA. You lived in New York. And you're like, I want to go to UCLA because that's where the game shows are moving. And he came back and gave you like a package for USC.
That's correct. in New York, they didn't know much about colleges in California, but UCLA was pretty well established by that time, just not in my college counselor's office.
Okay. I just thought it was funny. Also, my wife went to UCLA. So if she listens to this episode, which she might not, because she has to listen to me talk too much already. The idea that anyone, even back then, confused USC and UCLA is an insult. So,
yeah,
but you moved out there. You were from the time you were in college. And so you've amassed these things. Did you always have a sense that these things were the items you've collected personally? Did you always have a sense that these were important as a part of history, or did you always see them kind of as personal younger on and then later realize their significance for the past?
Well, my collection started with TV tickets. They were accessible. They were plentiful. So when I was growing up in New York, I would go to the various ticket offices and pick up tickets for the different game shows and other types of shows in New York. And then when I got out to LA, I was a frequenter of various shows. And so I would go to the ticket office, and instead of just getting one or two tickets for me and guest, ask for 8 tickets, and then the next day, 12 more, and then the next day, 10 more. And so I just started to collect these. And Real People did a story on me when I was in college about my wall of my dorm room, which was plastered with TV tickets. And they just thought that was so kooky that I was eligible to be on Real People, which is where I first met Byron Allen, by the way, who I work for today. And then I was working at CBS, and The Price is Right had a game called the Any Number game, which was the very first game they ever played on The Price is Right, the current version, in 1972. And they were retiring that set piece and replacing it with a new one they were building. And I called downstairs to the studio and I said, well, what are you doing with the old piece? And they said, well, we're just going to toss it. I said, no, don't do that. And they wheeled it up to my office on the third floor of Television City. And it lived there as long as I was with the network. And then when I left the network, I said, well, I'll just take it. Nobody cared. So I took that. And then that followed with other pieces, some from Price is Right. I have pieces from Family Feud, from Jeopardy, Gene Rayburn's microphone from Match Game. A lot of little stuff, props, and things that are part of our culture, our history. They're iconic for fans like me. And now, thanks to Chris and the folks at The Strong, we can share them with the world.
Yeah, what I love is that I just read a thing that just came out a couple of days ago, since we actually arranged this, that you met and gave Ken Jennings a ticket from the first day that Jeopardy taped.
Yeah, I became friends with the original GOATs from Jeopardy, Ken Jennings, Brad Rutter, and James Holzhauer, and came over to my house when they were all in production on the first season of The Chase, which is on ABC now. And I wanted to give them a parting gift, because you have to in game shows give a parting gift, right? So I have a whole stack of tickets from the pilot of Jeopardy with Alex Trebek. And so I went to the stack and I took out 3 of them and I gave them to the guys, and they were appropriately impressed with that memory, because they're all, you know, pretty much identified with Jeopardy, but they didn't have that. And then I got an email from Ken the evening of the first day that he had stepped in to host Jeopardy after Alex Trebek's passing. And he sent me this lovely note saying, "I had your ticket in my pocket today for good luck."
Oh, that's so amazing.
And I didn't expect that. I didn't know the tickets would have any real you know, impact on these guys, but Ken, I guess, wanted something special, and he chose that. I was really, really blown away by that. He's quite a man. And when the archives were just about to be announced, I reached out to him to ask if he would endorse them with a quote, and he was happy to do it. He's a good guy. All votes are great guys.
That's awesome. Now, you brought up something which I think very few people know about, this intersection between entertainment and archiving, which I suspect Chris is very familiar with. And so this is the question I've got for Chris now. You are building this collection. Obviously, you've got champions on your side, like Bob, who again, you know, has all of these things. But part of your job is to acquire additional materials, and you're up against a studio system that is profit-driven. So what have been the biggest challenges of bringing in the materials, and what have you gotten or know is available that's made you the happiest, and what is not there that has been the most disappointing?
Well, we're just at the very start of this. This is only a couple weeks old at this point. So we are in the identifying what's out there. What has been coming in through my email so far are especially those tickets, like what Bob has started his collection with. Although yesterday I got a great email from a winner on what was at that time in 77, the $20,000 pyramid. And he had asked for the category card for his final winning category. And he said, "Would the Strong Museum and the National Archives of Game Show History like that?" I said, "I would love that." And he gave me a link to his YouTube final appearance with Tony Randall when he really aced the pyramid in what, to an amateur like me, seemed like record time. So this was a great personal memento of his. It was an icon of tapping into one of those legacy shows that has proven to have incredible legs and has been around for generations. And it is those kinds of things, those personal memories, getting people to share those, whether they're fans, whether they're contestants, and especially we're looking for the stories and the stuff that people who are behind the scenes, those front of the camera folks, are better known. We would love their stories too. But all the people that go together, from the lighting designers to the music composers to the set builders, every one of those folks plays a key role in making these iconic images, these iconic programs. And we want their stuff. I hope that on their last day on the job, maybe they walked off with a few things. The same way that Bob got that.
It's the opposite of what Bob wants. Bob's like, "Really? You want them to walk away with?"
Here's a ticket I'll send you, Chris.
Great. Ideal. $20,000 pyramid. So those things are coming. We also have an offer that I need to get back to a guy who has the home versions of so many game show board games and card games, because that's where it reaches sort of reality for lots of us fans at home. And Bob is holding up a great box for a concentration game. So you can't be on the show, everybody, but you can play the show at home with your friends and family. And that is another layer of this impact on our lives, on play, on popular culture, on catchphrases that we all use.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say personally, it's like my father, me and my wife went out last night. My father lives in Nashville. He came over to watch our son last night. And I was like, "Well, what time do you think you'd be here?" He's like, "I'll be there at 5 because that's when Jeopardy starts." And we have watched Jeopardy together since it came on. I mean, like, that's what we, even my son, who's 6, he was like 4. He was like, "Is Jeopardy on?" Like, it's just kind of a thing that we know. And it's a part of, it's like a part of me and my dad's relationship. Right. And we have tried to take the test many, many times. And let me tell you, Shakespeare has gotten me. I can't read it. So I can't know it, I guess. Although I listened to an interview with James Holzhauer recently, and he's just like, read the children's versions, which was pretty insightful. So what is it then, like when you're trying to acquire this, is there anything you just like you were excited about at first that you just found out is just not there so far?
Well, I'm worried that some of, especially the iconic set pieces that people could recognize from the shows perhaps they grew up with years ago, are probably not around. Storage space for every organization is expensive. So those don't necessarily get saved or stowed for historical purposes, because companies that make these productions, they're always moving on to the next thing. So could we get design documents, blueprints, things like that, so that we could document how they look? We've got skilled exhibit builders here at the Strong Museum. Could we reproduce elements from your favorite game shows when we eventually get around to doing an exhibit, because we've amassed such an amazing amount of things we want to share with the world? We would love those background documents so that, and they're also frankly easier to store than a host podium or the
right
turntable or whatever mechanism that is on the show itself. So let's get the documents, let's get the blueprints, let's get the music scores, the shell scripts, all those kinds of things that are the ingredients that the magic happens out of.
So when a person comes to this, once you've got up and running kind of, you know, at the stage where you feel like you've got a solid collection, what should people expect when they come there? Is this for researchers primarily? Is it access to that? Is it more for the general public or what?
Initially, it's going to be for researchers. We have a 250,000 volume research library. Right now, we have research fellows who receive grants to come here from all over the country. In a pre-COVID era, it was from all over the world. They're working on their books, on their PhDs. They've got topics about toys and dolls and video games from all sorts of angles. And we want to be that go-to place for game show history the way we are for toys, dolls, and games and video games.
Where do game shows fit in your past? And I think it's always fascinating when people end up archiving things they actually really care about. And there's this dilemma between, I'm supposed to be as neutral as possible. Like, we know you can't be totally neutral. That's fair. But there's this sense of like, how does it affect you when you're dealing with a collection that you really, really, really are interested in? Do you feel tension there?
I do. And the Strong Museum for years has required curators to put in writing why we are adding everything to the museum's collection. So I can't just say, well, it's cool and we need one, or I didn't get one for my 12th birthday and this is my delayed gratification for this toy or game or you name it.
I come in, you're just playing with it, crying.
I've at least got to come up with a cover story and say, this is representative of this development in American life, or here's part of the continuity of play from dollhouses to The Sims. It's all part of us at least articulating what this has in a way of importance for representing our facet of American history, which is play. And you asked where my entry point into the world of game shows. My family tradition in the 1970s was to watch The Pyramid every Saturday night. And we loved that. I loved that there weren't shilling for products on that particular show. It was a little bit, to me, like Jeopardy, in that this is about proving your skill, your perceptiveness, your ability, whether you're the star or you're the contestant, that you can get what these connections are and you can get it rapidly and you can perceive what's being challenged in front of you. And I so admired that. I'm the guy who a day after a party thinks of the smart line I should have said to someone. But it's thrilling to see somebody who can nail it on that. And it was also disillusioning. A few stars that I had always admired were dunderheads in the clues that they gave out. And they played a smart character in TV or movies, but they were a dope on Pyramid. So I really admired the sharp ones who could do that so well. And it was every time, a thrill to watch Pyramid and something that I treasure as a family memory right down to the present.
All right, I want to talk game show history more with Bob, but I've got one last question for you, Chris. I got one last, and maybe Bob, maybe you know about this too. All right, this is a very nerdy question. It's going to be a needle in a haystack, but my mother-in-law was on Let's Make a Deal sometime between 1975 and 1976. And she won a really nice set of luggage that the family had for like forever. And we have talked about this so many times because my wife growing up in LA, right? She would go like be in an audience, right? Like they're a part of this, but only one of them was ever on it. And, you know, we've heard the story so many times, but there's we have no clue how she's like 75 or 76. I'm like, great. We'll sort through that. But is there a way, number one, to possibly find out like a list of guests? And number two, if you could, is the footage still available?
Well, I can answer that because this is a type of question that I get very often. There's a long period of time starting from the 50s up until sadly the 80s when most of the game shows that aired were erased. They were not regarded as having value once they had originally aired. The entire archives of shows and production companies like Chuck Barris and Bob Stewart and Barry and Enright, many, many, many of those shows just were erased or thrown away. The only company that saved most of their shows was Mark Goodson, Bill Todman Productions, which became Mark Goodson Productions and now is owned by Fremantle. And they have a library of about 20,000 episodes of old game shows going back to the 50s that were preserved. They still had to be transferred because they were on antiquated tapes, that some of which didn't make it. But when the Game Show Network started in 1994, I was there for the launch. We went about the process of taking many, many thousands of episodes from the Goodson Library and transferring them. Since then, there's a network that Fremantle owns called Buzzr that has that runs most of the Goodson Library. GSN still has part of it, but Buzzr pretty much runs all day long vintage shows from the Goodson collection. Sadly, Let's Make a Deal was not one of those shows that was preserved. There are random episodes that pop up from time to time on YouTube, and sometimes somebody had some recording equipment or knew somebody at the network who saved it for them. But the lion's share of shows from that 70s era, sadly, are gone.
Well, you know what? We'll there's a little consolation in knowing that those suitcases apparently lasted for decades. And that we still got my mother-in-law, who's awesome. So sorry, Jeanette, if you're listening. I probably already told you about this. Anyway.
American Tourister? Was it American Tourister?
I can't remember. I have to ask her.
I'll bet it was.
The funny thing is like, as you know, I mentioned earlier, like I wrote a comedy game show. It's kind of a mix between entertainment. It's not the kind of suspense and everything that we have in like, you know, for game show formula. But I read a ton about it. And I actually auditioned. I still get the real like audition to be on one of them, but I like wasn't. I don't think they were like, you were not enthusiastic enough. And then they it was like a team game, and they were like, so it was one of my students was like, hey, let's audition for it. And we got all the questions right. But then they said, so you guys are both last name Sawyer? And we were like, yeah. They're like, so you're related? We were like, no. And they were like, this is confusing. So how do you know each other? I was like, he was a student in my class, and apparently he got this far and asked me. And they were like, this isn't a compelling story. And then I argued with the guy
that it was. Yeah. Arguing is not a good way to get on the show. Yeah.
5 minutes. I absolutely. But at that point, I was pretty sure we were tanked because he seemed very confused about our relationship. But I've read about this. And what I love is like looking at game shows and the thought that goes into them. I mean, to create something that is compelling for generations It is. I mean, it's amazing because we change so fast. Our culture changes so fast. But some game shows have lasted through the age of like television, through the internet, and they're still kicking it. And so, Bob, what I want to know from you, someone who thinks about these things and is a master of this art, what's the perfect game show?
Oh, well, instead of telling you my favorite game show or the title of the show I think is the best, let me describe the process of how these come together and why the ones that are the best last for decades. And it goes back to the Goodson Todman factory, which was dedicated to creating games that would connect with the audience and cause them to interact with their television. Now, in the earliest days, interact with your television meant yelling
at it.
But when you watch Family Feud today, I defy you to watch an episode without yelling at your television. You still do, because you hear the question, you have your own answer, you feel compelled to beat the contestant to the buzzer, and you will yell out your answer. And that's why Family Feud, I think, is among the shows that are potentially going to last forever in one form or another. And as the media landscape has changed and the methods of interactivity have evolved with technology, you still sit and yell at the TV when you're watching Family Feud. And Family Feud took a year and a half or more to develop. It wasn't somewhere, a bunch of folks went into an office and said, hey, let's do a thing where we take surveys and we'll have people answer questions and they'll get points and they'll win and maybe there's a bonus. It was much more of a science and much more of a collaborative effort in the Goodson Todman camp at the time, that they would do run through after run through after run through every day for months and months and months. And they wouldn't even take out a show to market until they felt that Mr. Goodson felt it was ready. And Family Feud, by the time it got on, had been practiced and rehearsed and evolved and changed so many times that there was very little that didn't work about that show. And the format that's on today, more than 40 years later, is pretty much the identical format to what premiered in the 70s. And that's true of a lot of these legacy shows, many of which are on ABC now in their revival form. And they were all developed with time and care and experimentation. It was a laboratory. It wasn't just, a pitch document that someone went to a network and said, hey, here's a game show. Do you want to buy it? Today, a lot of that art and science is lost. And many shows do come to market much more quickly and sometimes unsuccessfully because they haven't been properly worked out. You're looking at creating a world where you have to create behaviors for civilians and hope that they follow those behaviors. And when you do run-throughs, you discover which of those behaviors are predictable and which of those are not. And then you have to adjust the format to create an exciting environment and an entertaining interactive experience. And if you don't do that, you'll find out on the air that something doesn't work.
This is what's fascinating to me too, is because, talking about Family Feud, you're right. I'll be yelling at the TV. And the best part is like how my experience is like somebody's confidently knows the last answer. They're like, what's wrong with these people? How can they not get it? And that's not the right answer. But they're like, who did they ask? Who do they even ask about this? Who are they surveying? It's like, there's always this bailout to be like, they were just wrong. And so many of these game shows, what I love about them is they're accessible to everybody, right? Like you sit down and watch Family Feud with somebody, me as a professor, I sit down with a guy at a bar and watch it, right? The guy's like a welder and we're both enjoying it. And so many of these shows, that's kind of the brilliance, right? The Price is Right, all of these shows, they kind of hit at something that unifies us. The thing to me that's fascinating is I've heard people say that if somebody pitched Jeopardy right now, nobody would buy it.
I would say that. I believe that.
It's So this is my question. Like, we've entered an era where there is a, you know, if Tom Nichols' book, right? The End of Expertise, right? There's this kind of idea. And yet still America unites around a show that holds up people that, I'm sure, it's a wide range of knowledge. I mean, they're not, you know, you don't have to be a, you know one thing narrowly, but it unites around making heroes out of people that know a lot. So how do you explain it's, how do you explain, is it just that it's been around a long time, or how do you explain its longevity even now?
Well, the core value of many shows can be summarized in a single line. Okay, the core task on Price is Right is, gee, I wonder how much that costs. And how many times a day does everybody say that? Whether it's something in a retail store or something online or something that you drive by and I wonder how much that house costs. I wonder how much that car costs. So it's a topic that is so prevalent in our American society. The core task on What's My Line, which was one of the earliest panel shows, was, gee, I wonder what that person does for a living. And when you're in society and you're walking down the street or driving by people on the freeway, you look at them and you wonder about them. You wonder what they do for a living. You wonder if they have a family. You wonder where they live. And this was a show that took that little bite of curiosity and turned it into a weekly event. And so when you get to Jeopardy does celebrate knowledge and it does reward knowledge, but it's knowledge that can be acquired. It's not knowledge that you're necessarily born with. You're not measuring people's IQs. Okay, these people study to be on Jeopardy. And the goats will tell you that they study nonstop and continually learn things and push them into their recesses of their brains. They can spit them out when needed. And if you analyze Jeopardy, you have to look at the board in three ways. Okay, the top clue is usually something that's very accessible and easy. Maybe it's a fill-in. Maybe it's a familiar phrase. Maybe it's a picture of something that's very recognizable. And you will jump in before the contestant because they have to wait and you don't. And you'll get there first and you'll feel smart. Okay. Towards the middle of the board, you may not know something, but you'll hear it when the contestant says it and you go, oh, yeah, I knew that. And you'll take credit for having known that even though you didn't get there first. And at the bottom of the board, when they say something that is completely foreign to you or something that you never knew or long forgot, you'll hear it and you go, oh, I didn't know that. So you've got all three realizations within every single category. And I think that is one of the keys to the longevity of Jeopardy is people say, oh, it's too hard. It's like, well, the bottom ones are hard, yes, but the top ones are really easy. And that's why there's an appeal to the show that you can always respond to something. And you at home don't have to say what is or where is. You can just say the word and you get your own credit for it.
Okay. So this puts so many things together for me right now, Bob, because I just listened. Planet Money, which is one of my favorite podcasts, just re-aired an episode. Apparently, like James Holzhauer's brother-in-law works for them and did an episode a couple years ago on him during the run. And I listened to the episode and I even gave it to my dad and was like, you should listen to this because my thing was James Holzhauer is not as hateable as he seemed on the show. Right. And you listen to the story, like this guy's really nice. He's really kind. Yeah. The whole account of the story, he's on there. And you're like, why is it that everyone, like people love Ken Jennings. I feel like nobody was like mad at him, but like people were mad at James Holzhauer. But I think you just cracked it for me because Holzhauer always started out with the hardest ones.
Right.
So you walk into that show going, I'll get some first. You go, no, you're not. Because he figured out that the Daily Doubles were never in the bottom right. category and they're never at the highest points. Never so he'd top. Run through those so he could double down on the double jeopardies, which as a gambler is a great proposition. So this makes perfect sense.
I was peripherally involved in a story about a legendary cheater who was on Press Your Luck in the 80s. And what he did was he memorized the patterns of the flashing lights by watching the show on a very early VCR and freeze framing the sequence and writing it down. And he discovered over time that there were only five sequences. Then he went on the show, having memorized it and practiced it, and robbed the bank of $110,000, which at the time was a pretty hefty take for a daytime game show. And everyone was like, oh, we shouldn't give him money because he cheated. And it's like, he didn't cheat. He was smarter than the producers and the network. And it's a legendary story. I did a documentary on it that aired on GSN. You could find it on YouTube. It's called Big Bucks, The Press Your Luck Story.
That's so fascinating, because this was something else that I remember reading about. This is that, like, the idea that these game shows are rigged could really ruin them, right? So, like, there's a quest to be, like, sincere and, like, you know, that the Price is Right, having people that just show up, putting them on the show, it you know, there's this honesty to it. But I heard a story that the reason Jeopardy started doing the question and answer, right? Like, you know, you don't ask a question, was because people, was in the 60s when it first premiered? Yeah.
So in the late 50s, there were many game shows that were dishonest. They rigged. The contestants were given answers before the show. The producers and sponsors were trying to make dramatic stories, but they neglected the fact that the audience believed that it was real. So they got caught, and many of the production companies were brought down by this. And the industry suffered a major blow, not just the game show industry, but television in general, which was still a pretty new thing back in the late 50s. So most of the game shows disappeared. A few were survived. And in the early 60s, the story goes that Merv Griffin, who was a major television personality and an entrepreneur, was on an airplane with his wife at the time, Julanne, and they were talking about creating a game show. And Julanne said, what about a game show where you give the answers? And the story goes that Merv said, that's crazy. Everybody just got in trouble for was giving the answer. She said, no, you give the answers, but the contestants have to come up with the questions. And the example that she allegedly gave was 5,280 feet. And he said, what is a mile? And that apparently was the birth of Jeopardy, which they did a pilot with a different title. And then ultimately it went on NBC daytime in 1964. It ran for 11 years. And then it was brought back briefly in 78 and then rested again. And the current version came on in 84 with the late Alex Trebek. And it's so much more than a game show. It's an American institution. And it's something that families make an effort to watch every night at dinner or at 5 o'clock in some houses. And it's that and Wheel of Fortune have been paired together in most markets as perhaps the most successful pairing of two television shows in the history of broadcasting. Wheel is in season 30, Jeopardy is in season 37. There's no reason to believe either one of them is going to end. And the secret to Wheel, by the way, is that you're playing a different game from the contestants. You at home are playing the hangman puzzles. You don't have anything to gain by the wheel landing on a higher amount of money. So you're just trying to solve that puzzle. And because the contestants are trying to gain money for their bank, they are going to take longer to solve the puzzle than you are, which is why when you solve it first, you feel really smart. And that's, I think, the secret to Wheel. I don't think it was an accident. I think it came from the dozens and dozens of run-throughs they did to get that show ready. But, you know, you always feel smart on Wheel because you always get there first.
I would like to say that, but sometimes I don't get it at all. I guess
I'll still give you credit for it. We won't count.
All right. So I just got a few more questions for you guys. Right now, I think the question is, who's gonna fill in permanently for Alex Trebek? And it's such a huge role. And I've seen people try it out. I think for all of us, it's never gonna be the same. Like it will get great. It will continue to be great, but it won't be the same. But so what historically, what has made a great game show host? And how has that changed over time? Because Alex Trebek was just a game show host. I love watching the old things and seeing him hosting different shows. And now it's more like celebrities right. come in. But what are the characteristics that make someone great at that? And then who do you think should take over based on that?
Who were your favorite game show hosts growing up?
It was certainly Dick Clark on Pyramid. I felt he was great, very approachable, very friendly. That's what I kind of looked for. And then one of the best parts ever of being sick when I was growing up was watching the Hollywood Squares and getting that kind of smart mouth dynamic from all the people in the grid and basically having a more neutral wrangler who could play to their strengths and let them get their sharp lines in. So those are some of the qualities I look for: approachability, keeping it all going so smoothly and apparently effortlessly, which I know it is not.
True. And you're right, Ben. Many of the hosts today are legitimate A-list movie stars, television stars. And that actually, in the earliest days of television, that was also the case. And then it became a profession. And the earliest game show hosts included people like Carl Reiner and Dick Van Dyke and Milton Berle and Jackie Gleason. And they were legitimate stars. And on the shows that had celebrities, you would very often see people like Lucille Ball and other top stars, even on Hollywood Squares that you mentioned, Chris, a lot of the stars were top talent from the time. But as the genre evolved, being a game show host became, a profession. And so many of the people who had started in radio as disc jockeys, who were trained in dealing with people and moving things along and being a good traffic cop, they found themselves on television. And you had what developed was, a cadre of a dozen or so, all men at the time, of the top hosts who would go from show to show to show. And, the Wink Martindales and the Bob Eubanks and the Chuck Woolery's and the Bill Cullens and so many of Gene Rayburn, Alan Ludden, I could go on and on, Monty Hall. Okay, I'll stop. But so many of them just went from show to show. And at the time Jeopardy came on, Alex Trebek was in the pool of game show hosts that were available at that time to host the show. It could have easily have been Tom Kennedy or any of the other, hosts who were out there, Peter Marshall, but Alex available, he was a good fit for it. He got the job. And then over time, he became Mr. J. He didn't start there, but he made it his own. He became so identified as the iconic presence of that show that, you couldn't wait to have him come into your living room every night. He was a comfortable face. He was somebody who made you feel good. He was somebody who rewarded talent, never put people down, and he had a wonderful calming voice. These are all qualities that have made the most successful game show hosts. And some of the celebrities who are doing it now are quite good in their own right. Drew Carey took over The Price is Right 15 years ago, and he has made it his own. At first it was like, who could ever replace Bob Barker? Well, Drew Carey has replaced Bob Barker, and he's done a very commendable job doing that. And then you get into the primetime shows, and you see Jamie Foxx and Alec Baldwin and Elizabeth Banks hosting game shows. And you know what? They're pretty good. They're really good. The shows are somewhat customized to their talent and their abilities. You know, Jamie Foxx is certainly a talented musician, and he's hosting Beat Shazam, which is a show about music. Alec Baldwin is hosting Match Game, which is a comedy-driven show. Elizabeth Banks is doing, I think, a phenomenal job on Press Your Luck. And that's a trend that's not going to go away. I think that whoever replaces Alex Trebek is likely to be a celebrity of some sort. I don't think it'll be someone from the game show host pool. And I think that'll be the case when Pat Sajak decides to retire as well.
Well, I just want to say that I love Drew Carey on Price is Right. And like, I spent most of my early life, and I felt like at first there was a kind of an awkwardness to it. And I was like, is he really want to be doing this? And now I just delight when I see him on there. And he's like, he's so perfect. He's an improv guy. He's got stage experience. He knows how to land lines, but he's also like really warm. And he seems like he's having a great time, which is what I think what everybody wants to see.
And another important facet is somebody who is able to step back and let the contestants be the stars. And that's part of what many of the top hosts have said over the decades. And that's why Alex Trebek never allowed them to say, here is the star of Jeopardy. It was always, here is the host of Jeopardy. And he believed the stars of Jeopardy were the contestants. A host who is able to put aside his or her ego and perform, it's a performance job, perform in such a way that they can highlight the talent and the abilities of the contestants, whether they're celebrities or civilians. I think that's a core value that the best game show hosts share.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate you guys being here. This is amazing, Bob. You don't know how much I'm like, I love game shows, and just getting to talk to you has been a gift. And Chris Bench is putting it together so that one day maybe I can use this PhD of mine and my research credentials to come write a book that ties it all together. So Chris, could you just, before we leave, tell people where they can find out about the museum, maybe some upcoming events and the types of just what you'll be doing there?
Well, the Strong Museum has been open to the public since the pandemic for almost a year now, since late June of 2020. So we are wide open. We are accepting guests. In a pre-pandemic year, 2019, we welcomed 600,000 people to our space in Rochester, New York. We're a 285,000 square foot museum building. We've got two floors of interactive exhibits about all sorts of dimensions of play. We are adding 90,000 square feet of space onto the museum that will highlight the history of video games and, crucially, provide the collections team with more storage so that we have room for the archives of game show history. And we love people of all ages. People come in family dynamics and family groups. We're great for kids, but I never want us to be the Chuck E. Cheese experience where the kids are having a good time and the parents are suicidal. So we make this an engaging place for people of every age, whether you're with young kids or not, or just remembering your own childhood. I love art museums, but no one ever goes into the Metropolitan Museum of Art and says, oh, that's just like our Monet at home. But they come into the Strong Museum and they see the toys and games of their past and they say, I had one of those. So we're not about famous people necessarily. We're about experiences that unite us, that shape us, that make us who we are today, because play is integral to all of us, whether we're playing on a sports field or at a card table with a board game or shouting those answers out to a game show.
Oh, man, Chris, you are great at this job. I love this because, you know, the thing I want to end on is, you know, we take for granted that we have these archives. We take for granted that when we want to know something, we can go do it. But it takes people doing work, finding funding. It takes people like Bob collecting things his whole life and being selfless enough to donate that so that we can go into this place. So I just want to really thank you guys for doing this. You're doing important work. And I hope that anybody listening gets a chance. And I hope I get a chance. I will get a chance. Actually, let's just say, when will I get a chance to come up there? But go check out the Strong Museum, and thank you so much for the work both of you have done to preserve our past and make us enjoy life.
Thanks for playing.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is up. Hold on a second. Have you given us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts yet? Have you written a review? If not, would you please do that? It helps a lot. It helps spread the word, helps us get the word out there. And we'd really appreciate that. Anyway, back to it. The Road to Now was hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer and the editor of this very episode is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music today, like almost always, is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy, Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Julia Adams, and Ann Williams and Frank Edwards. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our two newest supporters at the Lincoln tier, Hannah Grace Kelly and Dan Broughton. Thanks for joining us, guys. If you'd like to join us on Patreon, you can be in the Zoom room for our live recordings. You can be part of our third Thursday trivia nights. You can get bonus content. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you just want to go to our regular website, that's cool too. Go to theroadtonow.com. That's www.theroadtonow.com. You can search our back catalog. You can find quick links to content. You can even listen there. And you're going to wonder, why is this so good? And the answer is because it was designed by Seven Ages Design. If you're looking for a website, hit up Charles and Destiny. They're great. That's Seven Ages Design. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening and take care.